Welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Happy that you are with us today. Coming up in just a bit, curiosity takes center stage as the North Dakota Gateway to Science shows how scholarships are helping more kids explore nature and maybe even discover the scientist hiding inside them. And then later, we'll swap science and lab coats maybe with trail dust with cowboy poet and rancher Bill Lohman, where the rhythm of life rides through stories, verse, and the wide open West. And we'll preview the 40th annual Dakota Cowboy Poetry Gathering, organized by Bill. He is the original cowboy poet. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and this week on A Closer Look with the Monitor, we explore two challenges shaping the future of North Dakota communities: education and housing. First, Jeff Beach, deputy editor of the North Dakota Monitor, joins us to discuss the state's new experiment with reduced credit bachelor's degrees, programs designed to lower cost and speed the path to graduation for some North Dakota students. Then in just a bit, Fargo-Moorhead journalist Kaylee Kern looks at a growing rural housing shortage and a regional effort aimed at helping small communities attract workers, families, and long-term growth. Together, these conversations examine how North Dakota is adapting to workforce demands and demographic change. Joining us first is Jeff Beach. Jeff, welcome back to A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Thanks for having me, Craig.
Jeff, I understand that technical bachelor degrees have long required, but we're all kind of used to it, 120 credit hours and 4 years of study. But now North Dakota is experimenting with a different approach. The State Board of Higher Education has approved pilot programs allowing some applied science bachelor's degrees to be completed in as few as 90 credits. What exactly has North Dakota approved, and how does this differ from that traditional four-year bachelor's degree that we all, I guess, have come to know and love?
What they've approved is kind of a pilot program to allow colleges and universities in the North Dakota system to come with proposals for reduced credit bachelor's degrees, as few as 90 credits. It doesn't have to be 90 credits. It could be anywhere between 90 and 119. But the idea is trying to create bachelor's degrees that will help fill some workforce needs, create, you know, more avenues for people to actually finish their degree and do it with, you know, perhaps a little less student debt, or ideally no student debt in the end.
Dickinson State is the first campus approved for one of these programs, Jeff, according to your reporting. And what specifically will that degree look like, and who is it designed for?
So it's a applied science degree in management. So the applied science degrees is what are eligible for reduced credit programs in North Dakota. And these applied science programs are kind of more workforce oriented, even though they are a full bachelor's degree, but they're a little bit more designed for people in kind of the trades or in technical settings. So what employers have been asking for is, you know, they might have a group of workers in the oil industry or other fields, construction, where they have people with technical skills, and, you know, they might have 8 or 10 of those people, but they need one of those people to be able to step up into a management role and supervise some of the other folks that they work with, some of their coworkers. So they're trying to kind of streamline the path to a management degree, give people the skills that they really need to supervise coworkers, while not trying to necessarily require the full-on college experience that you might typically associate with a bachelor's degree.
So you've talked about how this could lower costs. Is it also aimed to maybe help working adults finish their degrees faster? Folks traditionally that have a lot on their plate when they go back to school.
Yes, I think, I think a lot of it is actually aimed at people who maybe have a 2-year degree already in their pocket, but can bump that up to a bachelor's degree and have those management skills that they need. But yes, it could be, you know, completed in as little as 2 years if you diligent and go to school in the summers and kind of take full loads and apply yourself. So it really could be done in a fairly short time period compared to a traditional bachelor's degree.
Critics, of course, worry now that shorter degrees will dilute the value of a bachelor's degree. What concerns, Jeff, or pushback have you heard so far?
So I think early on in the discussion about reduced credit degrees in the State Board of Higher Education, there was some concern about, watering down the degrees. And, you know, some people saw it as chopping off the last semester of a degree program, and where the, you know, with the higher level courses, which is not really what was intended. It's really kind of slimming down some of the non-core classes to the major. So some people were worried about, you know, are these courses going to be, or are these degrees going to be accepted by other colleges if somebody wants to go to graduate school? Would they be accepted by licensing boards? Would they be accepted by, you know, other colleges or employers if it has, you know, what some people suggested as putting an asterisk next to the degree. So they kind of pared that down. The State Board of Higher Education kind of pared down the kind of broader early approach, decided to limit it to these applied science degrees that are really more workforce oriented, making sure that they provide some good advisory guidelines for students seeking these degrees, so that they know exactly what they're buying when they sign up for one of these programs. And then each program has to be approved by the State Board of Higher Education on an individual basis. Dickinson State having the first one to go before the board, but they also have to be approved by the Higher Learning Commission. So there are quite a few guardrails that the State Board ended up putting on this program, and it does sunset actually. So it will, after a few years, it will need to be reapproved after they kind of evaluate those first programs.
Enjoying my conversation with Jeff Beach in this segment, A Closer Look with the Monitor. We're discussing an approved pilot program that will allow some applied science bachelor's degrees to be completed in as few as 90 credits here in the state of North Dakota. In just a moment, we're going to visit with Kylie Kern. We'll discuss rural housing shortages and a regional effort at helping small communities attract workers, families, and long-term growth by taking a look at that housing shortage issue. Jeff, we've touched on this briefly, but the pilot programs you talk about are limited to applied science degrees. These would exclude then degrees like nurses, nursing, and teaching, teachers. This is, I think, viewed maybe as a workforce experiment. Is this, though, potentially the beginning of a broader shift, Jeff, in how higher education will operate in the state, do you think?
I think it's kind of part of a shift nationally, really. I mean, I think there are a lot of colleges and universities looking at what, you know, a cliff in potential students in their state's population. North Dakota, really, from what I've heard, has not faced that same kind of enrollment cliff, perhaps. But they are, I think, colleges and universities are trying to get creative about filling more workforce needs, also about, you know, trying to keep the experience affordable for students. You know, the unemployment rate is really low, has been for a few years now. So that's kind of a disincentive for people to go out to college when they can enter the workforce pretty quickly at a pretty good hourly rate or salary. So I think this is a way to kind of reach out to some of those people who maybe went into the workforce pretty quickly, but now want to come back and maybe add another layer of skills to their resume.
How are we going to know if this is successful? In other words, what are evaluators going to look at to understand whether, you know what, this is the way to go?
Yeah, I'm sure they'll look at completion rates, You know, they'll get feedback from the business community that has kind of embraced this idea. You know, are they getting the quality of management material that they're hoping for out of some of these programs? One of the reasons why Dickinson State wanted to try to get this rolling as quickly as possible is so that they can have a couple of classes of people go through this program by the time the State Board of Higher Education policy sunsets, so that they have a, you know, kind of a student body experiment to you know, evaluate to see how this program has worked in its infancy.
Jeff, before I let you go, what other issues should we be paying attention to relative to higher education here in North Dakota?
Yeah, so the State Board of Higher Education has some big things on its plate. One is the funding formula that really the legislature is working on, but they are trying to be collaborative with the legislature on creating a new formula for how colleges and universities in the state are funded by the state. So that'll be something to watch going into the 2027 session. Some other things that they've been working on are dual credit policies for high school students and trying to create more access to those for high school students. That program has really taken off in popularity. Another area is shared services, which is a kind of using some of the larger universities in the state to help with some needs at the smaller colleges for things like financial aid and bookkeeping and payroll, and so that where some of the smaller colleges have had struggles trying to fill positions for especially in financial services, people with accounting expertise, and so the biggest example is North Dakota State University kind of taking over the books for Dickinson State University after Dickinson State had some accounting problems. So they're trying that. What has happened so far is it's kind of been on an ad hoc basis where a smaller campus has had turnover and they need help in the short term from maybe a neighboring college or one of the larger colleges. I think the trend is going to be that they're trying to figure out a policy to kind of make those more long-term agreements that might benefit the system overall. But they kind of need to work out a lot of the legal details as they approach that.
That's Jeff Beach. He's with the North Dakota Monitor, where he's deputy editor. He's joining us for part one of this week's A Closer Look with the Monitor. You can always read more of Jeff's reporting on reduced credit bachelor degree programs and his colleagues' great work at NorthDakotaMonitor.com. It's a website that's free from subscription charges, free from paywalls. Excellent reporting. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
A Closer Look with the Monitor continues. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and across rural North Dakota, communities are facing a common problem: not enough housing. Even towns seeing economic opportunity and population interest are struggling to build homes quickly enough to attract workers, families, and long-term growth. And we're visiting now with Fargo-Moorhead journalist Kaylee Kern about her recent reporting in the North Dakota Monitor on a regional initiative aimed at boosting rural housing development and what's at stake for small communities that are just trying to grow. Kaylee, welcome to A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
I'm glad that you are with us today. Give us a sense of this problem. How widespread is the rural housing shortage in North Dakota?
Yeah, it's a really widespread problem. Well, my story focused on an initiative specifically in the northeastern part of North Dakota. One of my sources who works in this field said it's a challenge across the state, and housing shortages then impede economic growth, which becomes a circular problem. And that's a challenge that a lot of communities are struggling with across the state.
I think of housing shortages in larger communities, maybe like Fargo, that can't find enough places for folks who want to come and work here to live. And I have never really considered it as a rural issue. What are communities and local leaders telling you about how the shortage is impacting their towns right now?
Yeah, I was surprised to learn about it too over the course of this reporting. The main problem has to do with jobs. In these rural communities, local employers, both public and private, are really struggling to fill openings, not because they can't find people who are qualified and interested in the job and interested in moving there, but because there's just nowhere for those interested applicants to live after they've been hired.
Your story focused on a regional housing initiative. What exactly is this effort and who's involved?
Yes, so I'm going to throw a couple of long names at you here, but the Red River Community Housing Development Organization, which as you can imagine is based in the Northern Red River Valley, started the Spark Building Initiative a few years ago to address barriers to housing supply growth that they were seeing in the region and across the state. Basically, how it works is the initiative acts as the developer for these homes. So they bring together financing from the state and from private lenders and then work directly with contractors and builders to then build these homes on lots that are donated by these rural towns. The homes are then sold like houses normally are. And the idea is that this effort will spark more independent growth in these communities over time.
Why has housing become such a central issue for economic development in these rural communities? What, I guess, industries are really sparking this need?
Yes, so there's been a lot of growth in different industries. And a couple that are coming to mind are manufacturing, as well as agriculture, also healthcare with the more rural hospitals around the state. And as we talked about, if there's nowhere for these workers to live, they simply can't work there. And that means that these employers who are looking to fill open positions and continue to grow can't do so, which stalls the local economy.
Schools and educators came to my mind mm-hmm. about rural areas that can find maybe a teacher to teach, but finding that place to live might be another part of the problem. What are the biggest obstacles? What are the biggest obstacles that are preventing new housing from being built in these smaller towns?
And actually, you raised a great point. Education and local schools are another industry that have been pretty hard hit by this issue. But to answer your question about obstacles, a 2022 task force identified quite a few in these rural communities around the state. The main ones are difficulty accessing financing, as well as a shortage of contractors, just because many contractors don't live in these communities, and even the ones that do might find it more profitable to work in bigger cities or to build more profitable custom homes in these rural areas. There's also not a ton of buildable lots in a lot of these communities. I know that might come as a surprise because we tend to think of rural areas as having a lot of open land, but farmland is sometimes too expensive for cities or developers to buy. And connecting new lots to sewer and other utility infrastructure is often very, very expensive. And, oh, sorry, just one more.
No, go ahead.
One other big barrier is something called appraisal gaps. So as you might know, when you want to buy a house and go to get a loan, the bank wants to have the house appraised to make sure that your loan isn't worth more than the house is. This process involves finding comparable houses in the area to compare your house to. And so, as you can imagine, when these rural communities don't have much new development for even just a few years, they lose out on these comps, which means that houses are often appraised at less than the cost of building. And that then requires contractors to pay the difference out of their own pockets, and that disincentivizes building.
Enjoying my conversation with Kaylee Kern. She's a freelance journalist in the Fargo-Moorhead area. We're talking about how rural North Dakota communities are facing a common problem, which is not enough housing. Kaylee, why is people working together, regional cooperation, important in tackling these issues, especially for smaller communities with, I'm guessing, limited resources?
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head there. A lot of these towns don't have many resources to be spending trying to develop their land and drive growth. And so by bringing these communities together and connecting them with resources and support, a regional initiative like this can help to, one, demystify the process, but also help officials overcome hurdles that they otherwise wouldn't have had the time or money or expertise to deal with on their own. And also the regional nature of this initiative helps a lot with advocating at the Capitol because the folks working on the initiative have more experience working with lawmakers and can help these communities better advocate for themselves and for what they need to continue to grow.
Are these initiatives creating housing that is subsidized in one way or the other? And if not subsidized, is it less expensive than it otherwise would be without these initiatives?
Yes. So that is one shortcoming of this initiative, is that the houses are not exactly affordable. So far, the ones that have been built have sold for more than $300,000. And that is, you know, still excludes a lot of people who are more low income or who might just be starting out. And so that's an area that the initiative hasn't quite tackled yet, though someone I spoke with from the initiative said that that's something that they're looking into more, because it is definitely a real need in these rural communities. I spoke with officials from Hoople and Lakota for my story, and they both said that it's a huge need in their communities, as evidenced by the fact that the few apartment buildings that they have are constantly full and have been for a long time, because there's such an unmet demand in these areas.
The people that you visited with, are they optimistic that they can make a difference, that the initiative will become meaningful and at scale?
Yes, they're both really excited about this initiative and hopeful that it can make a difference in the long term in terms of sort of providing a proof of concept that building homes in rural towns can be profitable. But again, they noted that in order to better meet the needs of their communities, there really does need to be that affordability aspect. And so they're hopeful that the initiative will develop either another separate initiative or a separate arm that can focus more on building smaller starter homes, twin homes, things like that to help meet that need.
That's Kaylee Kern. She's a freelance reporter in the Fargo-Moorhead area, and she's written about this issue for the North Dakota Monitor. Earlier, we visited with Jeff Beach. He's the deputy editor of the North Dakota Monitor. You can read Kaylee and Jeff's and all of their colleagues' great reporting without paywalls, free of cost, at NorthDakotaMonitor.com. Kaylee, thanks for joining us on A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Thank you so much, Craig.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Radisson Hotel Bismarck, offering a Mother's Day brunch buffet in the Terrace Restaurant, Sunday, May 10th from 9:30 to 1, featuring omelets made to order, Caesar-crusted chicken, an assortment of desserts, and more. More information online at the Radisson of Bismarck Facebook page.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, back with our conversation with folks from the North Dakota Gateway to Science. It's a hands-on science center where curiosity drives learning and where kids can experiment, build, and discover how science shapes everyday life. It's one of the great places in North Dakota for kids and families. Back with us is Emily Montgomery. She's a STEM educator at North Dakota Gateway to Science. Emily, welcome back to Main Street.
Hi, thank you so much, Craig.
Last week, we talked about all of the great things that are happening in May and then through the summer, especially with summer camps. I want to talk about the Dave and Delaney Popke Scholarship Fund and what it's used for and how it can help folks.
Absolutely. We are so honored to have the David and Delaney Popke Scholarship Fund. This scholarship is specifically for our summer camp scholarships, and it honestly helps us so much support the fund that contributes to people being able to explore and experience science, because STEM is truly for everyone. That is one of our core mission values within North Dakota Gateway to Science. So we have these scholarships available for families. That is available on our website. They can look at it and register via our website to see this and look into it more. And this scholarship we're so grateful for, because it contributes to specifically summer camp, and anyone can also contribute to this fund, and it goes directly to our campers so that they are available to go. So anyone can come to our summer camp. So it's grades 1st through 5th, or also our middle school campers. So I love this, because when you donate to that, or if you have a camper you would like to send using this scholarship, you know that this money goes directly towards that. And that's something that's so beautiful. So it's such a great opportunity to be working for a place where we know that our scholarships are helping encourage the next scientist that, who knows, could be on the next NASA team, or goes to work in a lab, or encourages women to be in STEM. So it's a lot of great things that doesn't just stay stagnant, that is for sure.
Give me a perspective on what camps are. We talked about when they were last week. They're coming up in June, in July, in August. They're throughout the summer. If I didn't know what summer camps were at North Dakota Gateway to Science, what would you tell me?
It is a beautiful, crazy, fun adventure. That is for sure. I run our summer camps with the help of our amazing educators on our team. I couldn't do it without them. And we have every single day that is different. So if you sign up your child for more than 1 week at a time, just know that your student will not have the same day every single day. So it makes it so fun, and everything is based on STEM, so that science, technology, engineering, and math, that student will be able to walk in the doors that Monday, maybe not knowing something about STEM quite yet, and that is okay whether they've had some experience with it or none at all. By Friday of that week that they are walking out the doors, they will know at least or a lot about STEM and every component, whether they are doing things with our summer camp educators that will be going outside on a nature walk. They could be having someone come in with a STEM career that's telling them about their career that sparks that hands-on connection. They could be doing dissections. They could be doing a lot of chemistry experiments. Everything is hands-on for them, and they won't just be sitting and watching. We like to brag we're a little bit more fun than school. So it's something that gives them the experience to be hands-on, which is a truly beautiful experience that gets them engaged in STEM.
You've not seen the fantastic building in Bismarck. When you do see it, you will agree this is a lot more fun than school.
Yes, I agree.
Emily Montgomery, she's a STEM educator at North Dakota Gateway to Science. You can learn more at their website. Best place for information, that's at gatewaytoscience.org. Thanks, Emily.
Yes, thank you, Craig.
Still ahead on Main Street, a campfire chat with the original cowboy poet. That's Bill Lohman, right after this news. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein in front of the 40th Annual Dakota Cowboy Poetry Gathering, which is May 23rd and 24th at the Medora Community Center in historic Medora. I'm pleased to be joined by cowboy poet, rancher, and artist Bill Lohman. He joins us to talk about preserving the culture, humor, and hardships of ranch life through poetry, from the Badlands of Western North Dakota to national cowboy poetry gatherings. Lohman reflects on a lifetime shaped by the American West. Bill, it's a pleasure to have you with us today on Main Street.
Well, thank you, Craig.
We have a common friend, Merrill Pepcorn, and he shared with me the article that appeared in this month's North Dakota Living publication. It's online. Folks can go there and take a look at the original cowboy poet, and it's you. What is it about this state that finds cowboy poetry worthwhile?
That's a good question. And I don't know, people that come to watch it and hear about it a couple of years later, they're on stage. They write a poem. They think, you know, that it relates to everybody. It's just common things that happen, and it's not Hollywood, and then it's real. It's and it relates to everybody, and it snowballs that way, and it isn't. And then some of us get to be professional or semi-professional entertainers and stuff, but and do a lot of banquets. But the ones that get on stage there and stuff, they're rookies at it and new at it and nervous, but the crowd is really appreciative to it. In fact, the ones that blow a line or make a mistake get a better applause than the polished ones. And it's really a good big family and appreciative, but it's preserving our culture, which is good. And this day and age needs preserved very bad.
We're enjoying our conversation with Bill Lohman in front of the 40th Annual Dakota Cowboy Poetry Gathering, May 23rd and 24th in Medora at the Medora Community Center. Bill, is the way cowboy poetry evolving, changing?
I've sat on a lot of committees out at the National Elko and stuff, and we've been not invaded, but there's a certain amount of ones coming in there that are free verse poets, which doesn't rhyme. I'm old school. To me, a poem, a cowboy poem, should rhyme. It should have its flow of meter, and it should rhyme. And we've got these free verse poets coming in, and to me, that's just you and I talking. It doesn't rhyme. It doesn't have a meter. Where's the art form? That's a rhyming poem makes it an art form over a regular conversation to me.
Bill, are you saying
we're getting a few of those?
Are you saying that cowboy poetry? Pardon? Are you saying maybe that cowboy poetry has changed since those early gatherings in the 80s?
It's not changed, but there's a few people coming in and the folklorists are open-minded to letting them do their thing and express themselves. But we've got a common joke about that and why they call it free verse, because nobody will buy it. But this is one thing, bringing these folklorists up. I do a lot of, I was doing 40, 50, 60 commercial banquets in a year in a seven-state area for all kinds of ag departments, doctors and lawyers, aviation, whatever. And I would get interviewed by the press, and we use cowboy slang. We don't swear or anything, but we use our English isn't correct. It's cowboy talk, and they would correct that on the interview, and that ruins it. And that's one thing the folklorists are go to school for and study for, and that's what they are. I really, really compliment them. They are taught to identify a culture and leave it in its nature. We leave it the way they found it. Leave it real. They don't edit our poems and stuff. And I really, really highly respect them for it.
Bill, you've spent decades trying to preserve this Western tradition, it seems to me. Are you encouraged by younger generations now taking an interest in cowboy poetry and ranch culture?
We've got some good ones coming out. That's another interesting question. On one of the committees I sat on out at Elko after it was going on for 10 or 15 years, people running it had quit their career jobs and were hired there to make it work. And they get to worrying about where are the kids, where are the young, where's the next generation? Are we going to be out of work before we retire? Where's our security? And I said at one of those conferences, I said, well, my poetry gathering back in the Dakotas, I get 35 to 65-year-old first-year rookie poets on stage that's never wrote a poem before, never been on stage. And they look at me with a blank look. And I said, my take on it is that when you're cutting a wide swath, when you're 15 to 25 or 30, you're out there doing the cowboy work, ranch life, whatever, you're cutting a wide swath, you could care less about writing it down. You're busy making history. And then when you reach middle age and a little older, you get to thinking, hey, maybe it's time we get this down, you know, for the next generation. So that really eased their mind. And I've been a firm believer in that. We get different ones every year come in that are in their 50s and 60s and have a good time.
Bill, I feel that ranch life is often romanticized by people far removed from it. And I think I might be guilty of that myself. What do you wish people understood about the reality, the realities of the cowboy way of life?
It's not, we make that mistake out here on the ranch. We invite guests out from different walks of life and treat them to a big meal and take them around and show them the place and stuff, and it's all glamorous, but we should show them where we're battling drought or trying to save some calves in a April snowstorm and stuff and pulling them at 2 in the morning and grabbing them out of a draw somewhere and hauling them into the shop and trying to save them and drenching them with Gulfstream and stuff like that. And it's not all glamorous, but we don't show other people that. We show them the better side, and I guess we're guilty of that.
You look back at your career, a rancher, a poet, an artist, an organizer. What gives you the greatest sense of pride?
Respect of my colleagues is one thing, but just the general public, the people we meet and stuff. And it's funny, that's another thing I've realized out on at the national level on these committees. We're all selling grass through a cow, but we have so many different subcultures through the United States of the ranching industry. You get out in the Southwest high desert buckaroo country. Buckaroos are some of my best friends, but they work for big corporate-owned ranches and do it the old cowboy way, and usually corporate ranches are wanting to lose money to make money, and they use the wagon and stuff. And those buckaroo friends of mine don't own a cow, they don't own a horse, they don't have a brand registered, they own an old pickup with a shell camper and take pride in their saddle and all their tack and take pride in how many big brands they have rode for. And us northern family ranches run our own business. We know the bloodlines of our bull, the protein in our feed. We sell our, market our calves and know where they're going and buy our bulls back and do all our business. And they don't have any idea of what's going on there. And it's odd. We'll be sitting there in a nightclub visiting, having a share and a drink, and we have nothing to talk about.
Are you riding as much as you were 10, 20, 30 years ago?
Probably not on the last few years, no. I guess the COVID pretty well shut it down, and then I was doing 20 to 40 or 60 banquets a year, and I never advertised for a job in my life. I just answer the phone. I've got work here at home, and if you do a good job at a regional one, why, those people will go home from that banquet. They're probably on a local board in their area. When a function comes up there, they'll give you a call, and you'll go across their board to be accepted. So as long as you're doing good work and stuff, it just kind of snowballs on its own. But I'm happy at home. I love my ranch work, and I, Baxter Black, are you familiar,
sure,
anybody with Baxter Black?
Who's not?
Okay, maybe our general public, because he just passed away here a couple of years ago. But he was our icon of cowboy humor, and we all looked up to him, and he was all our good friends. I worked with him several shows and stuff. But I know one case of a very good family man, poet, wrote very good stuff, very religious man, and he wanted to be the next Baxter Black so bad that he actually had a nervous breakdown over it and had to get professional help. It ruined him. He wanted to be so perfect on stage and stuff, and so his timing was off and he was nervous. And the basic law is, if you're having fun on stage, your crowd's having fun with you. If you're having trouble on stage, your crowd's having trouble with you. It's that simple. It's not that simple to achieve all the time, but it's that simple. And there was only one Baxter Black. Be yourself. Be yourself. Don't try to be a second Baxter Black. That isn't going to happen. Be yourself. Be your own personality and have fun. Enjoy yourself.
I remember his column. I think it was called On the Edge of Common Sense. And I would read that
Edge of Common Sense, yep.
In our local newspaper. He actually performed in Riverton, Wyoming, quite a while ago, just mm-hmm. after his big run in the 80s, where we all heard him on public radio often.
Yeah, he's been in Bismarck. I worked with him in Bismarck. I got him into Medora. Well, I got him to come in for our very first poetry gathering in 1987 in Medora.
Nice.
Yeah, and you know the funny thing? Well, we lost Baxter Black, and Don Edwards was one of the greatest cowboy singers in Texas, and Ian Tyson, he was from Canada, great cowboy ballads, and he was a hippie. Him and Sylvia were back east in the Bob Dylan era and stuff, and then they got divorced, and he come back out to Calgary and got famous for writing Four Strong Winds that Bobby Bear made famous. And they all come to Elko. They were all our icons that we all looked up to, and we lost all three of those 2 years ago in the same year. And, yeah.
Do you want to read a bit for us?
No. I'll recite, but I won't read.
Let me ask it again. Bill, then, will you recite for us?
I will. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, that's one of my things. Reading is boring. Reading a poem is boring. Reciting it is, you get it across better. I'll do the Ma's Christmas Tree.
Love to hear that.
That started this whole thing. It's actually the single poem that started the whole cowboy poetry movement up here in western states. We get people in from 7 states in Canada into Medora thing. It's Ma's Christmas Tree, and I told you earlier on the history on why I wrote it. It's all a part of Christmas, fetching Ma's tree in the cold. I could have took old Wrangler, but he's getting kind of old. So I caught up little Badger Gray and pulled down my old Scotch hat. When things ain't right around him, he'll turn inside out quick as a cat. My stomach was getting empty. It was almost dinner time. I had Gray rode down pretty good. We'd been through a mighty climb. Over in the Cedar Breaks, quite a ways from home, the snow was crusted most knee high. Over the dusty loam, I was dragging Ma's tree home with a rope. When the rope went under his tail, he gathered all four and went to the sky. You could say we really set sail. Every time we came back down on his rump, that axe handle would hit. I'd better pull all the leather I can, for dang sure he ain't gonna quit. I thought I was done for a couple of times, but managed to gather back in. You're just going to have to forgive me, Lord, if cussing's considered a sin. He paused for a minute when he lit next to it, Crick Bank Trail. It was then I saw my chance had come and jerked it free from his tail. We're both sweating and trembling now and hurting bad from fatigue. And I looked back over my shoulder and Ma's tree wasn't nothing but a twig. Ma's Christmas tree. And that was the poem that started this whole movement, basically. And we've, you know, and it's funny, my colleagues and I and stuff, I've got like six books out of cowboy poetry and short stories and cartoons and stuff. But you talk to other peers and stuff, and all of us have a half a drawer full of unfinished poems and some people, some of my peers will just go over it on the kitchen table and stuff and rewrite it and just fight it and rewrite it. And that's fine. But there's some of us that write on inspiration, and I'm one that writes on just when it hits me, I write it, and if it's not there, I don't write it. And I carry a notebook and a pen in my pocket, and I write it off the saddle horn. I write it off the baling tractor steering wheel. I pull over on with a pickup and a side approach and write down a verse. I get up at 2 in the morning when the verse is running through my head and write it down because it won't be there in the morning. And go back to bed, and 10 minutes later, another verse comes, and get up and write that down. Get back in bed, and Joanne says, I'm going to get a rubber hammer and put you out so I can get some sleep. And you know what I tell her?
I don't know.
I say, dear, I do my best writing when I'm not thinking. But, yeah, I'm a spontaneous. Some of us are spontaneous poets. It comes so fast that you can't get it wrote down. And if it doesn't finish itself, that's fine. I got other things to do. I got work to do. I'm busy. And then if it comes back later, I'll finish it. If it doesn't, it's in that drawer yet. And maybe it'll finish itself down the road. Maybe it won't. I'm not going to worry about it.
Bill, before I let you go, give us your best invitation to the 40th Annual Dakota Poetry Gathering. What should folks know, and where can they get more information?
Yeah, you can call me on the phone, 872-4746. It's at the Medora Community Center, which is a nice western facility there, and I'm sure a lot of people have been to it. And it's Saturday morning. We start, we have a special event at 10 o'clock. It runs from 10 to 11 to get started. And this started from when Elko, the National, shut down for 2 years with COVID. We never shut down. We kept going. But I and four other poets, one from Dick Gibbard from California and Waddy Mitchell from Nebraska and five of us around the country, the office would send us out, ask a cowboy poet question of the month, and then we would answer it back to them, and they'd send it out on Instagram. And that went on for 2 years until Elko opened up again. And then when it opened up, they took all five of us on stage in front of the 1,000 people auditorium and let the crowd ask us questions. And they dubbed it From Page to Stage. And it was really, we had done an hour and a half deal on that, and it was fun. So I took that concept back here, and I brought, there's three of us. There's one from South Dakota and one from Montana and myself. And we got on stage and done the same thing, From Page to Stage, and had them ask questions. Then the next year, I had to ask, that was Ask a Cowboy Poet. The next year, I had to ask a cowgirl poet, and I had three cowgirl poets on. And then the next year, I had to ask a cowboy, cowgirl songwriter. And it's really, really a fun deal, and the crowd gets involved, and it's just laid back. So this year, we're going to have Ask How to Present Yourself on Stage. And there'll be Merrill Pipecorn, myself, and Callie Peterson, which is the editor of the Rural Electric Co-op magazine. And we're going to be on stage, and guess who's going to emcee it? Kennedy DeLapp, Miss North Dakota.
Very fun.
She's going to emcee it. So that's going to be at 10 to 11 o'clock Saturday morning, and it'll be a fun time. And then at 1 o'clock both days, Saturday and Sunday, we have open session from 1 till 4:30, and then we take a break for supper, and then we come back at 7:30 each night with a professional show of cowboy poets and cowboy singers and girls, and it's a different show each night, and it's very popular. And then Sunday morning, we didn't quite know what to do with Sunday morning, because some of them had party all night and they weren't up yet, and some wanted to go to church, so we started a round robin of cowboy gospel singing. It's not preaching. It's cowboy gospel singing. And it's very, very proper. And we dubbed that separating the saints from the sinners. And that packs them in too. So yeah, it's a fun time. And the big part of the whole thing is, and for me, for all the performers and for all the people coming to see it, the big thing is the camaraderie and the friendship. That's the whole big thing about it. A lot of these people, we don't see each other for a year or two or whatever, a year and a half, and get back together. And just the friendship is the big part of the whole gathering.
We've been talking about the 40th Annual Dakota Cowboy Poetry Gathering, May 23rd and 24th at the Medora Community Center in historic Medora. Been visiting with Bill Lohman, rancher, artist, cowboy poet, and founder of the Dakota Poetry Gathering in Medora. You can read more in North Dakota's Living feature about the original cowboy poet. Bill, thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Hey, it's been a pleasure, Greg. Thank you.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 7th. Colonel Dwight D. Eisenhower led the 1919 Transcontinental Motor Convoy, a venture designed to test whether military units could move across the United States using motor vehicles. The convoy crossed the Great Plains and the Rocky Mountains to the Pacific Ocean, completing the 3,251-mile journey from Washington, D.C. to San Francisco in 62 days, but not without difficulty. The trip exposed the poor condition of American roads. Vehicles frequently became bogged down in mud, and soldiers often had to build makeshift bridges over deep ravines. When Eisenhower was later elected president, he had the opportunity to address the problem. He considered the interstate highway system one of the most important achievements during his two terms in office, a view still shared by many historians. In 1956, the United States government approved funding for a national highway system. North Dakota embraced the plan enthusiastically and was among the first states to plan and carry out its portion of the project. Prominent North Dakotans like Orrin Libby and Usher Burdick supported the effort. They saw it as a way to boost economic development by creating a safer, more efficient transportation network, one that could attract new business and expand tourism. The interstate highway system transformed travel, commerce, and urban development across the country. The interstates were designed as freeways with standardized construction and signage. While some older roads were incorporated, most of the system was newly built. Construction came at a cost, however, as an estimated 1 million people were displaced when highways cut through established neighborhoods. On this date in 1960, Interstate 29 was declared complete from the Canadian border to South Dakota. The 240-mile route passes through Grand Forks and Fargo. At its northern end, the Pembina Port of Entry serves as a key link for trade and travel with Canada. Interstate 94, a 324-mile east-west route, crosses North Dakota. Together, these highways form an important part of Eisenhower's vision for a connected interstate system. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for this Thursday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Monday on Main Street, another conversation with North Dakota Teacher of the Year Franny Tunseth and the importance of public schools. We hope you have a great North Dakota weekend, and we look forward to seeing you again Monday right here on Main Street.